Hello, I'm Chris Basden, an editor with AICPA's Journal of Accountancy. You're listening to the J of A podcast, where we talk about the key issues facing the accounting profession. In today's podcast, we're going to talk about how CPAs can protect themselves from lawsuits. Our guest is Sarah Ference, a risk control director with the CNA Insurance Company. Hi, Sarah. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. So we've got an interesting topic today. Obviously, nobody likes to think about the possibility of getting sued, but it is important to understand how it can happen so that you can implement preventative measures. First of all, can you talk a little bit about what your role at CNA is in helping firms protect themselves?
Sure, Chris. Well, I mean, in a nutshell, my job and my team's job is to help educate CPA firms on how not to get sued. So we talk to CPA firms and talk to them about the things that they can do to, you know, prevent a claim, a professional liability claim from occurring, or since we can't control what other people do, should they do find themselves faced with a claim, to help improve the defensibility of that claim. So my background is from public accounting. I worked with my firm for 15 years. My entire team was also formerly in public accounting. And we take that practical experience working at our former CPA firms, combine it with CNA's claim knowledge and history of you know, insuring and defending accountants' liability claims. And as the endorsed underwriter of the AICPA Professional Liability Insurance Program, and take all that together and help give our firms guidance and advice and education on what they can do in their practice to help prevent a claim from occurring or, like I said, improve the defensibility of one.
You know, one thing I think that most practitioners want to know is where they might see the most claims. So, Sarah, can you talk a little bit about what are the most common types of claims that you and your team see?
Sure. So, you know, historically, you know, in every year that we've had the program in place, and in including 2016, the vast majority of our claims relate to tax services. Last year alone, about 72% of our claims that were asserted against CPA firms in the program did relate to tax services. And like I said, that was the truth in 2016 and in prior years. And that makes sense because tax services are the most common type of service that a CPA firm delivers. You know, we insure about 25,000 CPA firms, and the one probably common service amongst all of those firms, from sole practitioners up to large regional firms, is that they all pretty much deliver tax services. So it makes sense that the highest volume of our claims come from tax services. But then when we're talking about dollars, the claims that are the most severe, which is just a fancy insurance word for expensive, come from, not from tax, but from services like audits, instances where CPAs are acting as a trustee or a fiduciary, or even investment advisory, where you have, you know, large dollars at stake, or multiple people relying upon the CPA firm's work product. That's where you get into some larger claims. In tax services, they tend to be smaller. However, there are some tax claims that are higher in dollar amount, and those usually relate to filings related to foreign investments or state and local tax issues. Those can be, when you think about some of the penalties that are involved in foreign filing or filings related to foreign assets, or double taxation issues when you get into state and local tax issues, those types of claims can get expensive.
So what areas in tax do you see the most claims in, just from a maybe not dollar amount, but in terms of, you know, just how many you see, and what are some of the assertions that are being made?
Okay. So in terms of tax claims, it's mostly preparation, because, again, that's going to be the highest frequency of service is income tax return preparation. And then the most common assertion in those tax claims are a combination of what we call failure to advise, which is really just, you know, you didn't tell me to do something and you should have, or the provision of incorrect advice, which is the accountant gave, you know, whether, you know, maybe took a different position than what was correct on a tax return, or just messed something up. And those assertions combined made up over about half of our tax claims last year. Other assertions that that we see in tax claims are like a filing error or a mathematical error, so whether it be a transposition of numbers, even filing is maybe missing a filing deadline, or so on. And then the other one that people are very surprised to hear about, but yet we see every year, is a client accusing the CPA firm of failing to detect a theft or a fraud at a client, which you would typically never see in a tax claim because, of course, tax practitioners don't have any responsibility to detect theft or fraud at a client, yet we still see claims related to that.
So that's interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about, in general, what practitioners tend to do, or maybe I should say tend not to do, that tend to result in claims?
Yeah, sure. So I guess let's talk about the ones that are the most frequent. Like I said, there's the two assertions that we see most frequently are providing incorrect advice or failing to advise altogether. And so I'll give you an example on each one of those buckets. So, and the provision of incorrect advice, and these are based on our claim history, but it generally relates to the practitioner's inexperience or not recognizing when they are outside of their area of expertise and kind of, and not being able to get to the right answer. So we had a claim where the CPA provided tax return compliance services for a client as an individual and then also his business. And the client entered into an agreement with one of their business partners to exchange ownership in some companies, and ultimately left the client as the sole owner of the company for which the practitioner provided those services. So the client had multiple businesses. The CPA did the returns for one of them, and there was a complicated transaction with the client and his partner amongst many businesses to basically leave the client as the sole man standing of the company. So as part of this transaction, it necessitates a change in accounting method from the cash to the accrual basis of accounting, and the CPA didn't recognize that this was needed. And then when the error was discovered some years later, the IRS did not allow a retroactive change in accounting method, which resulted in the client left holding the bag for the company's entire tax liability, whereas, had that election been made timely, the tax liability could have been shared between the client and his former business partner. So the client then brought a claim against the CPA firm for that additional tax owed, and then the recovery of the fees paid to the CPA. So that's kind of one instance where the client's lack of knowledge resulted in a pretty decent sized claim.
I see. So are there any other hypothetical examples that you think would be interesting to share with our audience?
Yeah. So talking the other one we see a lot, unfortunately, is a failing to advise. The client asserts that the CPA should have told them something, and the CPA did not. So an example of this would be when a CPA firm was engaged to prepare federal and state income tax returns for a longtime corporate client. And with longtime corporate clients, longtime clients in general, sometimes some of the formality of the managing that client relationship falls to the wayside over time. And the client grew in complexity over the years, and due to that complexity, hired a new president subsequent to an acquisition. So with the new president, who had experience in the industry, they questioned the CPA about a tax strategy that the new president thought the company should be employing. And it was known as it's called ICDISC, which is a structure whereby a significant portion of income generated outside of U.S. by a company is shielded from U.S. tax, but not getting into the details there. But sure. this tax strategy was available to the client, had been for many years, and the president of this company questioned why the CPA hadn't told them about this tax strategy before, and why they hadn't been availing themselves of it for many years, which would have resulted in less tax. So it turns out the client was eligible for this, And so they amended the returns that they could, but since there's a, you know, a short statute of limitations for which you can amend, or a short time period for which you can amend, they couldn't go back, you know, they went back as far as they could, but they couldn't go back all years that they were eligible for this strategy. And so the client then, of course, fired the CPA and brought a claim against them for the taxes owed in years that could not be amended. And that, in that case, you know, we look to it and say, you know, what was the client, what was the CPA firm's responsibilities? Was it merely just to prepare the return, or was it to prepare the return and provide tax advice on specific issues or so on? So that was an example of, you know, where, you know, maybe that scope of service wasn't so clearly defined. And might have, you know, had it been, you know, the CPA might have avoided that claim.
I see. So I know that you and I have talked about this a lot before. There's some key preventative mechanisms that practitioners can use to try to prevent these types of claims: engagement letters, knowing when to seek advice elsewhere. Can you talk about a couple of those things, maybe starting with engagement letters?
Yeah, and I, you know, if I sound like a broken record sometimes when I'm talking to practitioners or in articles or that we write or presentations that we give, I mean, engagement letters is probably the CPA firm's number one defense tool. It is what we, you know, as an insurance carrier, look to in defending a claim. That's the first document that we review to see, okay, what was the scope of service? What was it that the firm and the client agreed that the CPA was going to provide and the limitations of those service. And in about half of our claims that were asserted against firms in our program last year, there was no engagement letter. And that just makes it not impossible to defend, of course, but it's just more tricky. When you have that engagement letter, you have the meeting of the minds about, you know, what is it that the firm's going to do for the client. In addition to, you know, some of the more key, you know, business measures, whether, you know, being billing and termination provisions and dispute resolution and so on. But the scope of service in an engagement letter is so important. And I tell people, you know, it's not an administrative burden. It shouldn't be viewed as that. It's really just the written documentation of a conversation that's probably already happened between the CPA and the firm in terms of, you know, what they're agreeing to do.
And if people need to know how to write an engagement letter, I mean, there are examples out there they can use, right?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the AICPA tax section provides samples. We provide samples to our engagement letter or to our policyholders. There are also, you know, for-profit providers like PPC that provide engagement letters. You know, there are affiliations and networks that provide samples engagement letters. And what we would suggest is, you know, gather a few different examples, you know, see where the commonalities are, you know, find and create something that works best for you and your firm, something that you can implement. Because, you know, knowing an engagement letter is better than no engagement letter. So, you know, do something that you're going to be able to do and put into practice in your firm. You know, it does not have to be 10 pages. Ours are sometimes lengthy. We get that comment, but they're based on our claim history, so we want to make sure we're including as many protective provisions as we can.
Sure. And I'm certainly not a lawyer, and I'm not a CPA either, but it seems to me that when you've got a document that, you know, that spells out what you're going to be doing for somebody, then later on, if there is a dispute, it's not just a he said, she said kind of thing. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, documentation, you know, as hard as it is to implement as when you're in practice, and especially during busy season when a lot of stuff is going on, documentation is so important. And it doesn't have to be formal. It could be even just a quick email, you know, and if you can't, you know, can't figure out a way to implement a formal engagement letter in your practice, you know, documenting even in an email or some kind of quick, you know, quick writing to the client about what the scope of services is certainly better than nothing. And then the other thing that we look to that people are surprised to if there isn't an engagement letter is the firm's billing records.
Oh, okay.
So if the billing records are, you know, rather nebulous in terms of what kind of services were provided, that doesn't help. But if they're tightly written, even if, you know, we love it when they reference the engagement letter, if there isn't, but the, you know, but make sure you're, when you're writing your billing narratives, that it's consistent with the services that you're actually providing. Cause that's another place that can be helpful or detrimental in a claim.
Sure. And so talk a little bit about knowing when to seek advice elsewhere, because I know that's something else that you say is important for practitioners.
Yeah, I mean, there is so much regulation these days, and there are so many things going on. It is impossible to know everything. And so, you know, especially in our first example where we talked about that the complex transaction that the client had entered into, maybe this is something that was outside of the CPA's expertise. And, you know, it is okay to admit when you might have reached the limits of your knowledge and need to ask for another CPA's opinion or advice, you know, whether that's, you know, just consulting with one of your peers who might have experience in that to see what they think, whether that be telling the client that, hey, you know what, I value you as a client, but, you know, and I certainly want to continue to serve you. But for this instance, I'm going to have to ask that you, you know, find someone else to serve you related to this particular item, because I can't do that. It's outside the scope of my responsibility, and the client will be better served by you doing that. And it'll help you, of course, manage your own risk. We see this sometimes when, CPAs who are very used to providing, you know, individual and corporate tax services get asked by a client, especially a longtime client, to prepare things like a gift tax return or an estate tax return or something that's just the, you know, the non-standard kind of returns that CPAs might not make a practice out of. Sometimes they, you know, there's a lot of complexity in those returns, and in a lot of ways to mess up. So, you know, if you're not as familiar with something, you know, to help decrease your risk of error, you know, seek help elsewhere, or direct the client elsewhere too. It doesn't mean you're going to lose the client if you're honest with them and you're in knowing the limits of your capabilities.
Thanks, Sarah. That's been really helpful information. And thanks to our audience for listening today. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please check out our other Journal of Accountancy podcasts on Podomatic.